For the last several months, we've been reviewing the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, Four Noble Truths. And we've gotten to the part in Noble Eightfold Path that focuses on right mindfulness. So I started a few weeks ago to talk about mindfulness of feelings, Vedanupassana, and is the second of the four foundations of mindfulness. So that's our topic for this evening. Now, previously I've been reviewing the nature of the Satipatthana, and last week it was mindfulness of the body. And in that regard, it's important to keep in mind that refrain that I've mentioned over the course of the reviews of the Satipatthana, to be contemplating them internally, externally, internally and externally, rising, passing away, etc., etc. And also, atapi sati sampajanya, diligent, mindful, clear comprehension. So, as we go through this review, please keep in mind that the main objective or aspiration in this is to be able to relate to feelings in a way that is observant and non-reactive. Mindfulness of feelings is a core part of this practice. Well, here's a quote from Anallo's book, Satipatthana, The Direct Path to Realization. And how, monks, does he, in regard to feelings, abide contemplating feelings? Here, when feeling a pleasant feeling, he knows, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling an unpleasant feeling, he knows, I feel an unpleasant feeling. When feeling a neutral feeling, he knows, I feel a neutral feeling. When feeling a worldly pleasant feeling, he knows, I feel a worldly pleasant feeling. When feeling an unworldly pleasant feeling, he knows, I feel an unworldly pleasant feeling. When feeling a worldly unpleasant feeling, he knows, I feel a worldly unpleasant feeling. When feeling an unworldly unpleasant feeling, he knows, I feel an unworldly unpleasant feeling. When feeling a worldly neutral feeling, he knows, I feel a worldly neutral feeling. When feeling an unworldly neutral feeling, he knows, I feel an unworldly neutral feeling. In this way, in regard to feelings, he abides contemplating feelings internally, externally, internally and externally. He abides contemplating the nature of arising, of passing away, of both arising and passing away in feelings. Mindfulness that there is a feeling is established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how he abides to feelings. That is how, in regard to feelings, he abides contemplating feelings. Now, when we talk about feelings, that's the usual translation, mindfulness of feelings. And that's that translation is a bit of a misunderstanding. And it's a difficult term to translate, apparently. The term that I prefer and that many contemporary teachers prefer is affect. An affect is a subjective experience of impulsive reactivity to either a pleasant or unpleasant stimulation or cognition. So when we're talking about pleasant feeling, modern psychological researchers would refer to that as affect approach. An unpleasant Vedana would be characterized as an affective, affect avoidance. So consider that for a minute. What we're talking about here is an impulsive, intuitive, and fundamental process of all organic beings. There's a tendency, if you put a single cell amoeba in a little Petri dish, and you put a something that's nutritive in there, it will approach it because there's a kind of instinctual behavioral response that orients attention toward that nutrient and initiates movement to take it in. Alternatively, if you put something that's toxic in the Petri dish, then that little one-celled organism will withdraw from it instinctually. So that's a basic drive for all beings, and especially for us. So it's not as though we're supposed to not have feelings. The idea is to be able to understand the nature of feelings as a dynamic phenomena and relate to it as such, not as a self, not as a command to react. Now, a person can decide to react intentionally, mindfully, skillfully, can decide to react. Now, some teachers talk about that as being learning how to respond rather than react. Now, when we talk about in that quote, Vedana is characterized as a pleasant feeling in the body. Now, this can be something that's visual, auditory, olfactory, gustatory, or somatosensory. Same thing is true with unpleasant feeling. It could be a pleasant mental feeling, such as an attractive fabrication in the mind that is associated with a body experience, or another mental fabrication. Same thing is true with unpleasant mental feeling. And then the neutral feeling, which is physical and mental. I'm going to be coughing periodically as I'm talking because I have COVID. I'll be talking more specifically about working with this, which is what I've been doing. So I'm going to pause occasionally to cough because that's what my body wants to do instinctively. Now, people misunderstand neutral feeling as equanimity. That's not entirely accurate. Equanimity is the ability to be non-reactively aware in the experience, the subjective experience, of a pleasant or an unpleasant feeling. So there's an awareness of it, but there's also the ability to regulate one's response to it. And I'll be talking more specifically about that in a few minutes as well. Now, in the Sutta, talks about worldly and unworldly. A worldly feeling is the normal range of feelings that are primarily the manifestations of an untrained mind's response to a situation. Unworldly refers to the range of feelings that are the result of spiritual development. For example, the joy experience is a state of consciousness that is free from the hindrances and unified around kindness, compassion, generosity, and equanimity. Now, unworldly, unpleasant feelings are a different story. Now, I think I'm not really clear on what an unworldly, unpleasant feeling is. I'm assuming that I didn't look, didn't do enough research with Analio's work. He's got three books out about Satipatthana. And somehow or other, I overlooked what an unworldly, unpleasant feeling is. I do know that there is a state of mind, a very highly developed state of mind, that comes about as a person's consciousness realizes the depths of dukkha and the relentless capacity for craving and clinging. And in Christian terms, this could be considered the dark night of the soul. There's a sense of understanding how hard it is to live a life that is reactive to craving and clinging, and it seems unavoidable and inescapable, and that can create a sense of despair. I'm assuming that's what an unworldly, unpleasant feeling is. I can tell you that at one point many years ago, I had a momentary awareness that the sense of self-experience is very fleeting, and that awareness was noticing a very rapid arising and passing away of self-states. And it was like the mind was trying, equivalent of the mind trying to walk on ice, not being able to get traction, slipping all the time and falling. But the falling has no end to it. So I had this experience and it lasted maybe a second or two. And then it was over. But upon reflection, it was kind of horrifying. My mind recoiled from it. Affect avoidance. But it was an unworldly feeling. It wasn't because of any kind of circumstantial, external circumstantial experience. It was because I was realizing that the mind is making it up as it goes along. And I really, when you buy a body, that's what comes with it, and you can't really control that. So, Vedana is a chittasika. And chittasika basically means a conditioning factor that's reflected in consciousness. So in its context as a conditioning factor in the mind, it's associated with sanya, which is translated as perception. So Vedana and sanya represent a bridge between physical experience and how the mind makes itself relative to that physical experience. And they're both considered to be universal in terms of being a conditioning factor in every moment of consciousness. Anytime the process of selfing is created, there's a Vedana and there's sanya coming along with it. So generally speaking, you can consider Vedana to be the affective response to a stimulus. And sanya represents the identification process. Now, when I say identification, what I mean by that is not so much as visual cognition in its fully developed form. Light stimulates the optic nerve, and when it travels into the back of the brain, which is where visual processing occurs, there's an initial neural reaction that starts to separate one particular part of that field of stimuli, starts to set it apart from the other associated stimuli. So right now I'm looking out the window, and there are all kinds of different levels of light and color that are stimulating my visual process. Intentionally, I'm focusing on shape of a cloud outside. Now, the shape of a cloud is a fully developed cognition, but there's some part of the visual process that starts to differentiate one color from another. That's sanya, that's perception. Now, this is important to understand, because when we talk about five aggregates of clinging, and I'll be talking about that when I get to the further on in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. The five aggregates are form, feeling, perception, mind conditioners, and consciousness. So it's really important to be able to understand how feeling and perception are activated in terms of creating a sense of self. To not just understand it conceptually, but also to be immediately aware of it as it's occurring. That brings up another concept that's an important part of this. It's called papancha. This is not in the notes, so just kind of adding this in. Papancha is translated as the proliferation of fabrication initiated by a moment of perception. So what happens, this describes basically, is the mind jumping to a conclusion about what's going on and then about what to do about what's going on. This happens in a fraction of a second. So, speaking generally, it's immediate. It's an immediate response. But we can train ourselves, we can train the mind to be aware of this initial response in its formative stage. In other words, there's a feeling and there's a perception, but before it fully forms into some kind of storyline, there's an awareness of that as a phenomena, not as a self. And when you can catch that, that is a very important skill set in the process of awakening. So here's another quote from Anallo, a different book, Perspectives on Satipatthana, about feelings. Feelings can thus be seen as an intermediary between body and mind, with a conditioning effect in both directions. One aspect of this intermediary role is that whatever happens in the body is mentally experienced through the medium of feelings. The other aspect is that the affective tone of mental experience influences the body through the medium of feelings. The actual experience of feeling, thus, usually affects both body and mind. An exception is the attainment of the immaterial spheres, in which the bodily dimension of experience has been transcended and only neutral feelings are experienced. Now, that last sentence, the attainment of the immaterial spheres, there in their experience of jhana states, there are four immaterial states. They're very, very subtle and refined investigations of the way the mind functions without reference to any kind of sensory input. And there's an awareness of a feeling in that realm, but that feeling tone is not at all reflective of what goes on in the body, and it does not affect the actions in the body does not create any change in heartbeat or muscle tension. It's just a pure mind experience. But the Buddha apparently, supposedly, mastered these levels of jhana. There are considered to be eight of them. The last four are called the formless or immaterial jhanas. And realized that, yeah, you can get to this state of awareness, but as soon as you stop actively cultivating it, the world comes crashing back in again, and along with it comes dukkha. So this is when he started to develop vipassana to the extent of being able to understand how the process of self-organizing occurs, and to be able to realize that it is, there's no inherent self involved in that. It's entirely related to the interaction between the outer world and the inner world. In the process of awakening, it's called nama rupa. Nama is what the mind makes, and rupa is what the body experiences. Being aware of nama-rupa as the interchange between physical experience as mediated by feeling and perception and mental cognition, to be able to observe that interaction with detached interest is the way to cultivate the processes of awakening. All right, so vedana has these different functions, sort of key, and I'm just going to list off where it's found, and this is, I've already talked about it, but just for the record, if you will. It's the second of the five aggregates of clinging. It's the second of the four foundations of mindfulness. It is the seventh of the 12 links in the chain of dependent origination. I'm going to read off the different links of the chain. Ignorance, conditioning factors, consciousness, name and form, the six sense bases, contact, feeling, craving, clinging, becoming, birth, and death. So, when we are investigating how the selfing process originates, you know, in the quote from the Vedana Upasana part of the Four Foundations discourse, at the beginning of this talk, talking about the origination of feeling and the passing away of feelings, and both the origination and the passing away. That's what we're talking about here, is being aware of anicca, of impermanence, as an essential characteristic. And that feeling is the link. The Buddha taught that when you can be aware of feeling just as feeling, that interrupts the formation of a self. And you can reorganize the self that comes, or you can see through the whole process of selfing. So I'm going to reread that part of the second foundation of mindfulness. He abides contemplating the nature of origination, or he calls it arising, of passing away, both arising and passing away in feelings. Mindfulness that there is a feeling is established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how, in regard to feelings, he abides contemplating feelings. So, noticing that feelings are just moments of more or less reactive awareness that either pulls attention toward what's forming or wants to push away what's forming. to be able to be directly aware of that with enough detachment and acuity, adapi sati sampajanya, to see it as not a self. This is what it means. There is a feeling established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. Now, bare knowledge is noticing that that feeling tone is just a phenomena. It does not determine a self. It does not control a reaction to whatever the stimuli is, whether it's physical or mental. Very, very important insight. And continuous mindfulness. Mindfulness is one of the wholesome, universal wholesome chittasikas. It is assumed that when the mind is free from dukkha, mindfulness will be operating, will be active and engaged in the dynamics of that experience. Now, that active awareness is associated with what's called bare knowledge. I call it knowing. Sometimes it's called bare attention. And when you have that moment, and we have them more frequently than we realize, actually, mostly because we don't contextualize what the feeling is. We have that experience, but immediately after, craving and clinging takes over. But as soon as we have that awareness, and it can occur right after disregarding one of the hindrances and re-establishing direct experiential awareness to the sensation of breathing, that's a moment of bare attention and independent and not clinging to anything in the world. That's important to understand. The more we can stay with the sensation of breathing, the more we can realize presence, bare attention, and there doesn't have to be a self there. But I'm going to say this again. We are so conditioned to be lured into selfing that it's hard to realize the moment we let go and go back to the breath and we are purely paying attention to the sensation of breathing. That is a moment of liberation. Small L liberation, if you will. So, now I want to talk about the neurology or neurophysiology of Veda and how it's related to sanya, perception. There's a part of the brain, it's called the limbic system. And limbic is from the Latin, it means associated with or close to. So then there's the outer cortex, then there's the core, the center of the brain, which is primarily instinctual, and in between them is the limbic system. Within the limbic system are two neural complexes. One of them is called the amygdala. The other one's called the hippocampus. Now, the amygdala is, its function is associated with affective processing. And the hippocampus, its function is to coordinate the affective responses to higher levels of cognitive processing. Now, this association is what perception is about. Mind starts to disregard certain elements of the flood of stimuli because the feeling tone indicates there's something important there to pay attention to. And then the perceptual process starts to line up, if you will, different cognitive assumptions about what it might be. And this goes to that famous story about, is it a snake or a piece of rope that I've used, because it goes all the way back to the time of the Buddha, and it's very pertinent to understanding this limbic process. You're walking down a pathway late at night, it's not well lighted, and there's a figure on the ground, a form on the ground. Now there's all these other stimuli on the ground. That stimuli has a certain kind of configuration. And that configuration is associated with a particular feeling tone. And currently, there's an assumption that seeing a sinuous form elicits fear. It's instinctual. It's not something that we are taught. It's something that we automatically are alert to and fearful of when we're born. So there's this serpentine figure. The mind starts to build a case. This is Papancha again. Based on this visual data, which is incomplete, and fear comes up, affect avoidance. And so that affect avoidance in an initial perception overrides the higher cognitive processes, and the mind starts to react behaviorally, and we tense up and jump back, assuming that it's a snake. Alternatively, when we are more mindful, we notice that tendency to jump to a conclusion as a phenomenon, not as definitive, and look further and realize it's not a snake, it's a piece of rope. So now let me go further into this analysis, because there's a couple of other parts of the brain that are involved. When the initial signal, the perceptual signal, the jump into the conclusion part, starts to operate. Let me be clear about this. The amygdala and the hippocampus cooperate. Signal is sent to the memory center of the brain. Memory center of the brain, and probably instinctual in that regard, says, oh my God, it's a snake. That sends a signal to a part of the brain called the nucleus accumbens, which is also in the limbic system. And it sends a signal to the parts of the brain that regulate behavior. And it creates a scenario. This is scary, tense up, be prepared to run for your life. Okay, now this process is supposed to be mediated by another part of the brain that's in the cortex, called the preorbital cortex in the forehead. Its function is to interact with the limbic system and the what's called the association cortex, the memory centers in the brain, and kind of either give the go-ahead signal to action or inhibit action. It's called an executive function, but that could be misleading, because there's an assumption that there's an entity up there that is deciding, like a person who's running the show. That's not accurate. There's a function that's constantly going on, a feedback loop among these different neural pathways. But the function of the preorbital process is that it connects to the nucleus accumbens and the amygdala and the hippocampus, and sends a signal that either releases the kind of neurohormonal activity that activates the whole process, moves it further along, or inhibits it. And when the mind is untrained, when we react to the stimulus without mindfulness and without the discipline of right effort. The preorbital cortex has been overridden by the limbic process. Now, this is pretty normal. This is the default mode of how we respond. Now, the whole notion of is it a snake or a piece of rope is kind of dramatic. But the same thing is true about anything that we like or dislike. The same processes are evolved. There might be more energy, more impulsivity, because the signal strength is strong, or it might be subtle. But when we're not mindful, what that means is that the mind jumps to a conclusion and acts on it. Now, at the most basic level, the jumping to conclusion is that there's an ego. There's a self that should be or is in control. That's the most fundamental misperception. Back to that whole notion of sanya. The misperception that that which is impermanent and conditioned is permanent and not so much conditioned, but enduring and autonomous. So that's important to understand. Now, let me also say this about the nucleus accumbens. There's been a lot of research about the amygdala, the hippocampus, nucleus accumbens, and the preorbital cortex. When we are researching addictive behaviors, the nucleus accumbens is stuck in the on position. It is hyperactive, if you will. And it has overwhelmed the function of the preorbital cortex. And what does that creates, well, what how that happens, let me put it differently. How that happens is that there's an unpleasant feeling tone that has been overridden by a hyperactive nucleus accumbens. Let me say it again. If there's some kind of emotional upset in the system, the selfing process, anxiety, now this is the realm of my professional training. When someone is depressed or has an anxiety, problem with anxiety, there's approach avoidance. The mind wants to be rid of it. Something comes into one's zone of apprehension and access that can create a strong approach affective response. For example, if someone is lonely, insecure, taking in a substance like alcohol or marijuana or something else overrides the avoidance, masks it. And so what happens is the preorbital cortex it becomes disabled and is reorganized around actions, controlling actions that will get more and more of the drug. Now, I'm very much simplifying this process, but this is basically what happens. In the 12-step system, the 11th step is meditation, daily meditation and prayer. And I don't want to go into a long, elaborate breakdown of the 12 steps because it's very Buddhist in the way it functions. But in terms of the 11th step, which is daily meditation and prayer, there's the ability to strengthen wholesome associations and empower the preorbital cortex to override the craving and clinging that is manifested by the nucleus accumbens supersedes addicted behavior. Now, there's still the problem of underlying anxiety or depression that must be dealt with. So, once again, being aware of the unpleasant feeling tone either physical feeling tone or mental feeling tone, negative self-talk or something like that, has to be understood from a perspective of Adipi Sati Sampajanya, diligent, mindful, clear comprehension, as a fabrication in the mind. And the feeling tone, the urgency, the unpleasant urgency associated with the anxiety has to be regulated by the empowered nucleus accumbens, and the empowered preorbital cortex to send a signal down to the limbic system and says, it's okay. And reorganize all of that neural wiring, if you will. Now, we can call that cultivating serenity or tranquility, which is one of the seven awakening factors. So I just wanted to put that in there because that's really important to understand. Now, how does this relate to mindfulness of breathing? When you bring attention to the sensation of breathing, what comes with that sensation is a neutral feeling. It's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Now, we are vulnerable to feeling tones that are either pleasant or unpleasant. Think about that in terms of what I was just describing. We're vulnerable to having our attention drawn away from the neutrality of breathing because it's not very exciting. When there's a positive or pleasant feeling tone, that's exciting. When there's an unpleasant feeling tone, that's exciting. Depending on the signal strength of that feeling tone, it's more or less exciting. When you pay attention to the sensation of breathing, that's not exciting. Now, what comes along with that neutral feeling tone is physical calmness, emotional calmness, and physical relaxation, and the mind becomes less and less cluttered with stories associated with pleasant or unpleasant feelings. This is what we call samadhi paucity, or it's called also called upachara samadhi, access concentration. So, developing attention to the extent that it's possible to stay with the breath, or what I call the breath body, which is what I talked about somewhat last week, being able to stay persistently aware of investigating changing nature of sensations in the breath and in the body as a whole, unified field of awareness, creates a strong bandwidth, if you will, strong radiance, neurological radiance emerging from the preorbital cortex down to the limbic system. It's basically, you know, what I'll call the chill effect. You just are less excited. But in order to stay with the breath, you have to maintain alertness. That's what the diligence part is about. And when something distracts you, you're aware of it and aware of the feeling tone of it, the feeling, the impulsive reactivity of what attracts your attention. You learn how to be aware of the feeling, but non-reactive to it, to not create a story around it and to not escalate the reactive energy associated with it. Now, I'm going to come back to my experience the last couple of days of being affected by COVID. It's the first time in my life I've experienced COVID. And I am vaccinated and double boosted and so forth and so on. The variant that's around now is apparently very infectious. Despite my being careful, I got infected somehow. And I'm taking medication for it. And I'm getting better. But when this first happened, there was this strong, unpleasant irritation in the trachea, like from the base of my neck down into the upper chest. Just irritated, irritated, irritated. And there was a strong affect avoidance tendency. It started on Monday night, 2 nights ago, and I laid in bed all night, didn't sleep very much at all, watching this with curiosity and noticing that to the extent that it was just an objective, unpleasant feeling, the mind could be calm. When I started to become apprehensive, that signal strength of that unpleasantness got more dysregulated, and I would start to cough. I also would notice that sometimes the coughing would happen spontaneously, and I would notice how the mind was responding to that. Mostly it was sort of like, okay, this is happening, stay present, you know, let it pass, and it would pass, and it would go back to the level of irritation that it was before. So I was watching the mind-body interaction, the nama-rupa, very carefully, and watching the sensation of breathing, which I'm trained myself to do. Then yesterday morning, I started to develop a headache associated with it and went to the pharmacy and got COVID tests and asked, I have COVID, and got medication and started taking it. And last night, it wasn't as impactful, but I was still watching. I was still having disrupted sleep, still watching. Watching how the mind was being affected by the strong physical discomfort associated with the area in my throat and chest and in my head. So watching all of that, practicing mindfulness of breathing all the while, because I've trained to do that. Right now I'm noticing there's this irritation that's moving from the upper part of my chest up to my throat, creating a reaction. So I cough. Now I'm back to talking again. So this is mindfulness of feelings. This is how it operates. Now, I'm not saying that this made things better as far as the illness is concerned, but what happened was I made use of the opportunity the illness presents to understand more about the interaction between what happens in the body and how the mind makes itself relative to that. So, this is associated, what we could say is, this is how, in regard to feelings, he abides contemplating feelings, independent, not clinging to anything in the world. So not clinging basically means, it doesn't mean that I can't get sick or injured. It means that I'm aware of it, adipisati sampajanya, I'm clearly aware of it as a phenomena of nature, and for the most part, less and less reactive to it. Now, that's on the basic worldly feeling level. When the mind gets really well developed, typically on a retreat, it moves beyond that worldly level to the unworldly. Not necessarily in terms of attainment of jhana states, but more in terms of being able to notice. I mentioned earlier that several years ago on a retreat, I noticed that since the experience of selfing was arising and passing away very, very rapidly. I alluded to being trying to walk on ice and not being able to get traction. So the notion of self was coming and going, coming and going, coming and going, multiple times a second. I was not able to get it to cohere. And that's part of the stages of waking that's called arising and passing away. And that, I alluded to that in terms of the unworldly, unpleasant feeling. It scared me. So that's how this process gets further developed toward awakening. What I understand is that should that happen again and my mind is well prepared, I would be able to stay aware of that arising and passing away for extended periods of time, and that would be one of the doors to awakening, to nirvana. There would be a realization that this is the nature of reality. And with that realization would come a relinquishment of notion that there is an enduring autonomous self. So that was a very important insight that I experienced many years ago. I don't know if the conditions will ever be appropriate for that again in the future, but that's an important insight that's associated with mindfulness of feelings. Okay, so that's the talk for tonight. Now the opportunity is available for us to, for you all to ask questions or make comments about your experience. Julian.
Thank you, Peter, especially today because even though you are experiencing COVID, you decided to share with us. Thanks. And my question is also about this part of the text that is about unworldly category. So you just gave us an example or unworldly unpleasant feeling. And my question is, like, the worldly pleasant feelings are kind of bliss states of jhana states, or if you can give an example just to have an idea of about those.
Well, in terms of the seven awakening factors, joy is a worldly pleasant feeling, experience of joy. So that would be in the realm of worldly. Now, in terms of jhana states, joy is characteristic of the first jhana. But in the process of cultivating jhanas, joy is considered to be not as rewarding as tranquility. So the next level of jhana moves from joy through happiness to tranquility. And so that's when it starts to leave behind the worldly, in terms of jhana practice, to the unworldly. And when you get to the fourth jhana, the dominant feeling is equanimity. And equanimity, the power of equanimity is such that any interest in sensory experience fades away. And that's how the experience of the formless jhanas, the immaterial jhanas, starts to form. Now, I was on a jhana retreat once and I experienced the fourth jhana, and it was sort of like my attention was flowing very rapidly in a very steady way down a channel, and there was less and less interest in anything that was going on in the environment, in the body, in the room. It was just fading out. It was just pure consciousness. So I did not get to the state, the immaterial states, but I have a sense of what that would be like. And so I guess that would be my comment. Like I said earlier, I'm not really clear on what unpleasant immaterial feelings would be. I don't remember reading about that in my research. But the main thing we're interested in is how do we make use of feelings? How do we bring mindfulness to the experience of feelings in a way that benefits the process of awakening? And that's why I was talking about the unpleasant physical experience associated with the COVID. And when I first started thinking, oh, I have COVID, and I went to get the test, I wasn't alarmed. I mean, I think I'm well protected, but I wasn't particularly alarmed. I was just curious, okay. I've been expecting this to happen because it's happening a lot these days. Let's see what happens. What's going to happen next? And that's how I went into it mentally. So the mental feeling was neutral, was neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Okay? John? Oh, John's frozen. Was there other questions you had, Julian? Yeah, go ahead, Sharon.
While John gets unfrozen, your description was really wonderful in the way that you described your awareness and of your body sensations, because that's what I tend to try to do, is to become very focused on the sensations that are occurring when I have anything that begins to feel like a change that might be to, that my body is not in good health. And I've been doing that for quite some time successfully when I can do that, because what it does is it alerts me to, I use supplements that sort of nip things in the bud, in my way of describing, or maybe turning things around. Even a headache, something like a headache, tells me that I can put my attention, and I've done this at night. Sometimes I rarely get a headache, but if I do, and I just lay there and I focus my attention on the pain, and then I actually think about relaxing the part of the head that hurts, it actually goes away, which I think is phenomenal. And
Yeah,
what you're talking about,
most headaches are caused by muscle tension. There are a whole bunch of
right.
muscles that extend from the neck up across the skull. And when a person does that, you keep letting go and relaxing, even in the experience of the pain of the headache, the pain can go away because you're taking charge of the tension that's going on.
Right. And what you described, as I heard you say it, a burning sensation at the base of your neck, and I'm thinking inflammation,
Yep.
burning,
Yep.
inflammation.
That's what it is.
So, and that, these are signals that we can learn to understand what's going on physically in our bodies. And then, of course, the other part that is even more challenging is the sensation of emotions, which really take, that's actually harder for me, but I'm working on it, and I think I've improved to read when the heat goes up emotionally or maybe in a different direction. So I do that throughout the day when I can, and that's part of my practice, is doing these kinds of things throughout the day when I'm interacting, or when I'm even just not involved with other people, or just seeing where my mind is and what it's doing and how it's affecting my body, which is an interesting thing to do.
Yeah, it's interactive. It goes both ways, as I alluded to in that quote from Anayo. When something goes on in the body, it can activate the mind to create a story. And when something goes on in the mind, it can send a signal down to the body that creates various kinds of reactions in the body. So it's really important to be aware that those two processes are dynamically occurring. That's a very important process, part of the process of awakening. Whether we're ill or not, just going through normal daily routines to be aware of that Nama Rupa is a core part of the process of awakening. Okay, let's go to John now. Go ahead, John. Can't hear you. Can't hear you. Sorry. Now you're muted. Now it's frozen. Okay. Anybody else have a question or a comment? Because we're getting close to the end of the time tonight. Steve.
Yeah, thanks for actually conducting this, Peter. Two days. I know you've got your symptoms. I also had noticed early on just that slight change, and that slight change also was in the throat. And over a period of, that next day, you could just, observe and notice the arising, just the rise of the change to into its peak, and its peak was, just very unpleasant and, could be distressful, particularly with any problems breathing, which, I did not have in this case. But even for my wife, the symptoms just seem different for each person, individual, depending on whatever might be there as vulnerability.
Yeah. And part of the phrasing is internally, externally, both internally and externally. And I talked about this a couple of times over the last few weeks. The externally can be kind of inferring what it would be like for someone else, because I've read about and heard about all the kinds of severe symptomatic reactions that a person can experience with COVID. And I was wondering, I wasn't really worried, but I was wondering, wow, I wonder what it would feel like if I was not just that my throat was irritated, but I couldn't breathe. And so I can empathize with someone who, not necessarily just with COVID, but someone with chronic COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, I guess is what it is. So you can have this sense of empathic attunement as well. All right, so we've run over quite a bit of our time tonight. So we're going to put an end to the meeting. But I do want to point out that next week it will be Zoom again. The meeting hall won't be open until the 10th. And the topic for next week will be mindfulness of the mind, third foundation of mindfulness. So let's sit for a moment.
Thank you.
Thank you for your practice. I wish you well. I hope we're all reasonably safe and happy and healthy until the next time we have a chance to chat.